Well, could the earliest Americans have walked the dinosaur? Well, I probably not. But they thought they fought dinosaurs, and maybe they did. At least part of their tradition is that that they were there while these giant beasts walked the ground, flew through the air, and swam in the oceans and lakes. It is part of their story that Native Americans tell. Fossil Legends of the First Americans is the work of Adrienne Mayer. It's the follow-up to The First Fossil Hunters, in which she took a similar lens on Greek and Roman myths. Or are they, in a way? I mean, what's so fascinating about this is that the earliest Native Americans were doing some of the best paleontology, and it would be years before white European academics would catch up. Except we kind of only know that now in hindsight. We'll get to that in just a minute. Also, the UFO connection, which I've only just heard about, so I'm fascinated with. Where does that end up going? And we'll talk about how common it was for these early Native Americans to believe in thunder birds, thunder beasts, and water monsters in a way which should inform us all to not so easily dismiss a good monster story, for behind it may be truth. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponet. Adrienne Mayer, your stories are as interesting as your story itself, so let's start with you. Everybody describes you as an independent scholar of natural history, folklore, and perhaps the creator of kind of a new discipline that more people ought to follow up with. But tell us a little bit about your background as an independent scholar. How did you get so qualified that Princeton is publishing your books?
Well, that was rather bold on my part, but it worked out for me. I started, I wasn't a good student, but I really loved researching things that I was interested in, and I was interested in things that were unexplained. So I started by reading all the ancient Greek and Roman authors that I could find in translation, and every time I came to something that no one could explain, and I looked for a footnote, and there was nothing there, and it seemed like something bizarre was happening, strange creatures, paranormal events, unexplained things. I would start a file on those things. And even though I was working full-time at places like the post office and insurance companies, I kept my files going until they got fat enough to write an article about it, and then I would send it into a journal, and if it got published, then I'd move on, and pretty soon I had enough on my resume that I dared to write a book, and I dared to send it to Princeton University Press, and they published it. That was off.
Well, so you're a little bit like, and I make this comparison gingerly because I'm, you know, you might push off from this a little bit, but it's a little bit like Einstein.
Oh, you were,
well, I mean, you are. You were doing, yeah, I mean, especially when you mentioned the post office, that reminds us Einstein was working in a patent office, and
and
he had his theories, and he was whipping off his letters and his comments on these journals and the other things that he was interested in. It was a long time before somebody took him seriously. So how long before people started to take you, Adrienne Mayer, seriously?
Well, I hate to tell you how long my research lasted, but I'd say it took. I'd say my research took about 15 or 20 years before I actually even thought about writing a book and daring to, you know, propose it to a university press.
Well, good
but,
job.
But you know, things would go faster now because of the internet and, you know, all the research that took me just painstaking, labor intensive. Searching in libraries and old books you could do online now. So there's hope for people out there who want to follow this path.
Well, and I think that's interesting. We talked to a few autodidacts on this show from time to time. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, frequently it's you folks who aren't beholden to the academic rigors or to the system that allows you to sort of just follow your curiosity in a way which led us to things like the theory of relativity, because there was nothing attached to it other than just, could this be true?
That's right, and I agree with you. I think as an independent researcher, a scholar, autodidact, whatever you want to say, non-academic, you're an outsider, but that's such a great advantage. You don't have
right.
blinders. You haven't specialized. I mean, I couldn't do my work without the help of experts who've devoted their life to one narrow field, but they don't see the same patterns that I do or that someone like me would see, you know, reading far-ranging interests and things like that. You see a different sort of pattern. I often referred to myself as a guerrilla scholar.
Right, right.
I got a trespass in all sorts of fields, and I was nervous about it at first, but I found out that specialists were relieved to be able to pass along these scraps of information that they had. They couldn't see a pattern.
Right.
It didn't mean much to them, but I was interested in it. They shared it with me, gave it, and they were happy to give it to me because I was going to do something with it, and they weren't.
Right. It's amazing what you could do, which they couldn't do because they'd have to, you know, suffer through withering looks from their colleagues at lunch.
Absolutely.
You know, they have to be somebody giving them the eye because they're investigating something which is outside of the mainstream of accepted academia.
That's right. I'm actually asked to evaluate a lot of scholarly manuscripts now, which is I sometimes think I can't believe what's happened to me, but I'm evaluating a manuscript right now on monsterology, and it's going to be a great book, but the guy says he gets those withering looks from his colleagues. He's at a university, and not many people at universities study monsterology.
No, they don't, and they should. And what a cool major. And just think if they had more majors like monsterology, how many more people would sign up for that than accounting?
That's right. And, yeah. You know, I'd like to point out that my first publications were in Cryptozoology Journal.
Oh, were they really?
Yes, I was one of the first members of the International Society for Cryptozoology, and I got to meet Richard Greenwell before he died, and Hoovelmans and all those guys. So I started as a cryptozoologist, and invented my own field of paleocryptozoology.
Yeah, and that's kind of the cool thing because, I mean, you've proposed some things that people will be following up on, and who knows what they'll name after you someday, you know? Well, I really mean that because, I mean, this is breakthrough work.
Thank you.
I think it's kind of a new field. I took your books with me down to on my vacation recently, and it would make for some great pool reading too, because you tell these stories well. So we'll get into some of these monster stories, if you will, these legends. But let's start with just a quick notion, and then flesh this out. That is in a way. I would say as long as there have been human beings on Earth, there have been paleontologists. They just didn't know they were doing paleontology.
Absolutely. What I'm investigating are the very first inklings of paleontology, the first scientific impulse, if you will. I mean, of course, people found fossils. You find things that you can't explain. They don't look like familiar animals to you or creatures that you know. And you don't just toss them aside, you speculate about them, you try to come up with some sort of explanation. Humans have always done that, and they always will, and I think they deserve more credit for the theories and concepts and the insights they came up with before science.
Right. Expressly on that idea of the idea of these early paleontologists, let's go back to the Greeks and the Romans.
Yeah.
There was a time when you didn't have to do any actual digging to come across dinosaur bones.
Absolutely. For instance, as I found in Greece, first of all, Greece and the whole Mediterranean area is an earthquake zone. I mean, there are just constant seismic events and that jumbles up the bones so that they're unrecognizable, fossil bones of extinct creatures. But on the other hand, it reveals them all the time. And they also just erode out of riverbanks. They would erode out of landslides or even during a thunderstorm. These things would just be emerging constantly. You'd find them when you were plowing your fields. In Central Asia, where they find dinosaurs in the dinosaur fossils in the Gobi Desert, they're constantly being revealed. They just, I've heard paleontologists say that Protoceratops dinosaurs are so ubiquitous they're a nuisance because they're looking for other species, and these things just constantly erode out.
Yeah.
So they're obvious to any passerby in antiquity.
Right. And this is true, too, would have been true for the earliest Americans for they could be out on a horse just riding through the desert, as one of your illustrations indicate.
Yes.
And there just might be the entire skeleton of some ancient bird or
right.
reptile.
Just laid out there on the ground in the chalk and the pterosaurs and, the flying reptiles, their fossils are often articulated right there in the chalk so that it's a dark bones in white chalk.
Right.
I mean, you would just be really struck by the image of it. And of course, they rode out, so you see them, and then they disappear if you don't collect them and take care of them. So they're just constantly appearing and then disappearing.
Right, and so too. They would actually collect them. I mean, what would be part of a story? Like, what would be a typical story? What would be the? Because it seems like there's sort of two ways of approaching this. They would collect the bones. We have record of them using them for medicine and for other things. But then they would also build a story around them at the same time.
Well, if you want to talk about the Greeks and Romans,
You do it wherever you want to go with that, because it's kind of a big topic.
Well, what's interesting is that these were just very much part of their cultural landscape and their natural landscape. So, they would come across these emerging fossils whenever they're plowing fields, whenever there's a severe thunderstorm, whenever there's an earthquake or landslide, something like that. And they would actually collect them, measure them. Measurements are quite rare in antiquity, and yet we have many measurements of, like the length of the thigh bones, the skull capacity of these fossils. They would take them to the temple. The temple would be the museum, and they would display them there in the temple for everyone to come and see. And marvel at, and they would be identified as the remains of either monsters from myth, giants from myth, or even ancient heroes from ancient myth. So they really took care of them as they were almost custodians.
Right.
So they were paleontologists. They were doing exactly what paleontologists did, and they tried to, like scientists today, imagine what they looked like, what their behavior was, what killed them.
They would try to put flesh on the bones.
Absolutely.
They would try to, so literally and physically. So, like the story, say, of the griffin.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, tie those two things together, if you would.
Yeah. Well, the griffin, the fabulous gold guarding griffin, first appeared in Greek literature in about the 7th century BC, so 600 BC, something like that. When they and this happened when they began to trade with the Scythians, the nomads who lived in Central Asia, ranging from Black Sea all the way to the Gobi Desert. The Greeks had never seen griffins, but the Scythians told them about these creatures. They said that the griffins were but large creatures with four legs, a beak, and that they made their nests on the ground, that they gathered gold and put gold in their nests. They had wings, but they never flew. They were earthbound. They preyed on deer, horses, and humans. They were fierce, four-legged predators, but they had a beak like an eagle. No one ever knew whether they had fur or feathers or scales. There were controversy over that. But the Greeks.
But stop right there. Even how interesting that is. That in
yeah.
a way, I mean, later on, sort of in the Jurassic Park film era, where
yeah.
that later we're talking about the fact that these early dinosaurs very likely had feathers.
Yeah.
But I mean so
and that the Greeks even imagined that maybe these creatures had feathers. They speculated exactly like scientists today.
Right, but yeah. they were right.
And they were right. And
they were
also right to say that they were like birds.
Right.
They noticed
so they were making this connection between reptiles and birds thousands of years before. And if you had said this, I mean, this is the part that always kind of gets me.
Yeah.
And this goes back to the cryptozoology piece. If you'd gone, if in the 1980s you had said, you know what, I think that these dinosaurs were originally covered in feathers, you would have gotten laughed out of your college job. You would have.
That's absolutely true. You wouldn't be hired at most of the museums and paleontologists had to go through a lot of grief to get their these theories out there until they finally found the evidence of it. Now you can find evidence of feathered dinosaurs in China, but what's interesting to me is that the ancient Greeks and these Scythian nomads created artworks that depict griffins. Some of them have fur, some of them have feathers, and some of them have scales.
How about that?
Yeah, so they they also show them taking care of their young.
Right.
There are no depictions of baby monsters in antiquity except for the griffin.
Well, and so let's set aside the griffin for the moment and come back to the Native American experience, because you could make a similar argument for their pursuit or their legends around the monster of the thunder beast, right? Yeah.
Thunderbirds.
I was thinking of the bear, pig, thunder beast, the big ones with the big, where the story started developing about these giant beasts that they would have battled in their past, that they were still telling stories about.
Oh, yeah. The warriors, the old tales of the warriors going out to Badlands type areas in western Montana and encountering gigantic lizards. They describe them as sort of lizard-like creatures with really frightening, with horns and big claws. And what's interesting to me is that they, in the story, they say that the warriors tried to use their lances against this giant lizard, and they found that its hide was as hard as rock, like stone. And that just made me think that, you know, there are a lot of mummified dinosaur skeletons found in Montana and other parts of the West. I wonder if that story comes from some sort of observation of a mummified.
Yeah.
And they've thought of it as a lizard. So.
Well. And so,
we call
and
them
so,
reptiles. So.
Yeah, and that's the thing. They called them lizards. We call them reptiles. Mm-hmm. If somebody had said giant lizards, we'd be like, yeah, right. And so what are we to believe then about these lizards and these Native Americans? Can we be so quick to dismiss their stories that their ancestors physically battled these giant lizards?
Well, we know that that's absolutely true in Australia. We know that the first Aborigines who arrived in Australia did in fact battle giant lizards that are now extinct. So, I mean, that's true in Australia.
So why can't it be true here?
I know someone who is studying stories of flying snakes. Lots of Native American tribes have stories of sightings of flying snakes going way back to the first records that were taken up to the present. There's a guy named Nick Susick who is gathering all of those stories and analyzing them.
Let's pick that up there next. Tell us, do you have any of the flying snake stories handy? I mean, what that would have meant? Because there's so many of these things and I want to get to them, and
I know, there's just too much.
Okay, there is. It's just too much. We'll get back to it. Adrian Mayer is next. Fossil legends of the first Americans. Let's pick up on that subject of flying snake stories of Native Americans. Why that could not have been true. Why not? And then as long as we're talking about flying things, let's get to the UFO question too, coming up in the next half hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll get back to those flying snake stories here in just a second. Fossil Legends of the First Americans is the new book out by Adrian Mayer. The First Fossil Hunters was her previous book. And it kind of along the same idea, exploring the relationship between paleontology and folklore, kind of finding out along the way that folklore was doing it better earlier than paleontology was. No big surprise there until you actually get into the details, and that's where the surprises come from, just how accurate some of these stories were. And then we'll get into some of these Native American myths in particular, or what we called myths. Maybe they weren't. Maybe these are just maybe these were historical records of these actual encounters. We were just talking about that before the break. We'll get back to there in just a second. But first, I did get the blog up at coasttocoastam.com if you missed crypto news. And there's a picture of my dog, Jack. Some people have been asking for that. I was talking about him a while ago. I got him from Boston Terrier Rescue of Minnesota. I'm big into rescue dogs. The average Boston Terrier is supposed to be somewhere between 11 and 15 pounds. And Jack is 34 pounds. And it's not because he's fat. It's because he's a mutant. He's huge. He's like a mini boxer. He's just ginormous. And he's completely fixated on squirrels. And so I put up the photo. Now, I just want to say, let me apologize. The photo is big of me and Jack. And last week's photos I put up of my whale watching tour, those were like thumbnails. I went back to try to put bigger versions of the whale photos because they actually deserve to be larger photos than my face. However, I was unable to fix that. I don't know why. At some point in the future, maybe I'll try and reload those photos in and see if I can't repair that. But in the meantime, the blog is up at coasttocoastam.com if you want to, and hook up there and see the picture of that good-looking young man on the left. That's my dog. Fossil legends of the first Americans. Flying snakes in our record. And what about the giants? What about we've talked about the fossil records of the lizards. Well, what about the giants that lived amongst us? Next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Okay, so actually, there's a story on the website at coasttocoastam.com tonight, which plays in perfectly to this discussion we're having about fossil legends of the first Americans and the folklore and the paleontology work done by Adrian Mayer. Adrian, I don't know if you saw this, but remember the Hobbit skull, they were calling it, right?
Yeah.
Did you hear recently, and this story is up at coasttocoastam.com, that researchers have determined that, in fact, the little mini skulls that they found were not human skulls, were not Homo sapien skulls suffering from dwarfism.
No, they're not. They're another little species of hominid.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that a little sort of mini hominid.
Yeah.
Which speaks to, we would have thought, any discussion about hobbits or any other separate miniature species of us would have been just the stuff of folklore or myth. And now we have an actual skeleton. And so now we have to look and wonder whether somehow the very origins of those mini human stories might have come from a time in our past. It might have been passed down from ancestor to ancestor when the time existed when we coexisted with little mini versions of us that might have been running around, and we just haven't found their skeletons except in that one place. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I think it's actually plausible because I actually know an anthropologist who's done a lot of field work in Indonesia and Borneo where they found the little mini skeletons. And he's actually collected a lot of folklore, oral traditions of people, local people from those areas where the little mini skeletons were found, who have stories of smaller than normal humans, little people. And he's collected those stories. So those people were not aware of the fossils. Their traditions are about actually interacting with those little people.
And what would that have been like, that they lived in separate areas, but occasionally there would be get together times or times where they might help each other out,
or
do you remember
probably trade. I think human beings traveled and explored an awful lot more than people have acknowledged, especially academics have not acknowledged, because they don't have what they consider proof. But I think if you think about it and you put together all the evidence that we do have of interactions, I think people interacted with very distant and remote tribes and groups much more than has been recognized. So I think there was probably trade. They you explore, you see who's over the next hill. I mean,
right.
Humans always do this.
You know, and if they're paying their taxes and mowing their lawn, hey there, you know, you just kind of wave as you move past your neighbor. You don't have to, you know, and that's, I think, the part that's interesting is that a lot of these Celtic legends, for example, maybe it's just that we haven't found the skeletons yet in Ireland that says, in fact, hey, how about that? There really were what some people would call leprechauns. You know, maybe there really were something like that had existed at one time.
Well, that's just it. That's what drives us on is the possibility that we're going to find something that we didn't know existed. And we've got to have that, and we know it's out there, and it'll either come to light or not. We certainly don't have the entire fossil record, that's for sure.
Well, let's talk about the fossil record that we have, too. Adrian Mayer's book, Fossil Legends of the First Americans, you talk about the giants. So we go from the little people to the giant people. And there were Native American stories of what, even battling with giants.
Yes, they call them the stone giants. The Iroquois called them the stone giants, which implies that they had armor of some sort. Now, of course, you have to think that when people are really isolated, different ethnic groups have different sizes. I mean, I actually wrote an article about fighting giants in antiquity, in ancient warfare for MHQ, Journal of Military History. And some peoples, like the Romans, were about 5 feet tall when they fought the Germans. The Germans were 2 feet taller than them. And so they met a whole race of giants then.
So to them, it was a race of giants when the Romans were really only 5 feet tall?
Yeah. Have you ever gone to a castle in England and looked at the armor?
Yes.
I mean, it's teeny.
Yes. Oh, no. I looked at Henry
VIII.
We're big
now. We're giants.
I looked at the Henry VIII armor that was in that's in the Tower of London.
I know. You think of him as such a big, imposing
Exactly. He was like a chubby kid.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, wait a second.
He's like a little hobbit guy to us.
Yeah. And I was surprised at his legend is so large, and yet that breastplate, I understand he outgrew that armor at some point, but for him to have been that size at one point, it was mind blowing.
Yeah, that's right. And I was going to mention, I know that a few years ago there was a tomb discovered in Israel, and I can't remember exactly where it was found, but archaeologists found it, and it had an inscription on the tomb, and the skeleton was oversized, much larger than you would expect for that time period, in that time period. And the inscription was labeled Goliath. I mean, I haven't heard any more about that. I read one scholarly note about that, and I haven't heard any more. I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, I'd love to travel back through time just so I could be the Yao Ming of ancient Rome. I'm just walk around a full 8 inches taller than the tallest Roman at the time.
Absolutely.
But about the Native American legends of giants, I mean, what do we think of? Do we think that they had mistaken mastodon bones for human femurs? Or, I mean, and could it be that these, as some guests have talked about in the past on Coast to Coast, that some giant people isolated might have survived into a period where early Native Americans might have begun to pass down stories of their encounters?
I don't think that's impossible at all. I think that's possible. I mean, when the Spanish conquistadors went to Patagonia, or when the first Spanish and Europeans went to Patagonia, they did, in fact, find tribes of people who were incredibly tall. I think that in Greece, now in ancient Greece, when they found fossil bones of, say, a mastodon or a giant rhinoceros, because it's all jumbled up because of the earthquakes, all they find are these big bones, like a limb bone, a thigh bone, a shoulder blade. It looks, because it's a mammal, it's an extinct mammal, it's a huge one, much bigger than anything they've ever seen, but it looks just like a human shoulder blade or a human thigh bone. You can understand why they thought that there were giants populated the earth, you know, in the prehistoric period, and that all the ancient heroes at Troy were striding around three times taller than people are today, you can understand it. But the Native American stories about giant bones, they'd find the skulls too, and so they would know that they were, whether they were animal or human. So I don't think we can explain it away by saying that they were finding mammoth bones.
Well,
I think it's entirely possible that there were very large people in certain areas, regional areas.
And it makes you think, okay, the Thunderbird stories, the stories of these giant, you know, sort of man stealing or baby taking birds or other, that couldn't have been out of the question either. That in fact,
no.
You know, that these birds very likely existed, and it wasn't just a matter that they had found the bones of a pterodactyl in a hillside somewhere.
No, you know, the stories of the giant raptors that could swoop down and take animals and small children and even small adults, those are real. Those are real because we know that that paleo Indians overlapped with giant condors from the Pleistocene, from the Ice Age, and giant birds called pterotaurs.
And how big would they have been?
Well, just to give you an idea, an eagle's wingspan is about 8 feet.
Right.
A condor of today is about 9 feet. A giant condor was about 10 feet, but a pterotaur was 12 to 15 feet. Wingspan. Now that's a small airplane.
Right, exactly.
That is a scary bird, and it could in fact pick up things with its claws, not its beak.
Sure.
The paleontologists have seen that it actually swooped down and got things with its claws. So those things overlapped with early Native Americans throughout the United States. They have found the remains of those giant birds in New York, Canada, the Pacific Northwest, the Southwest, Mexico. I mean, that's what accounts for those stories of giant birds.
How long was it before mainstream science accepted that idea that the Native American stories of giant birds weren't just myths?
I don't think everybody has accepted it.
Even still?
you and me and our audience.
Well,
but the thing is, they have found, scientists are persuaded now that there were giant pterotaur-type birds overlapping with prehistoric people in Africa because they have found the skull of a young child that has puncture marks in the skull that fit the claws of the giant bird that lived in the same region. So this baby or child was taken by one of these birds, eaten and left in the nest, and now they have found that. So scientists are going to come around to this.
Well,
this acceptance.
And I could look through the book real quickly, but I'm sure you remember. Where is it? In Arizona, where there's the giant bird with the man in its beak?
Yes, that's in Petrified Forest. Anyone can go see that. I give the place under the caption in the picture in my book. I went to see it, and the forest.
It's a petroglyph of a giant.
It's a petroglyph. It's rock art, and you can stand a few feet away from it and see it. It's a large bird with a little man in its beak.
And somebody might dismiss that as some sort of god legend or something, or you could say it was the photograph from the front page of their newspaper. Giant bird, you know,
exactly.
steals grog, you know, this just in, grog taken by giant bird, and they chip it into the rock so they can all remember poor old grog and what happened with the giant bird.
Exactly. And what was interesting to me was that there was a forest ranger there at Petrified Forest who had talked to a Hopi elder who had come to see the petroglyph, and then he saw that and was reminded of a Hopi story of that very same kind of event.
This was something which almost was like passed down like a like a warning, like don't let this happen to you kind of story. Or
I think these stories were they're about a real danger. Yeah, there's a Yaqui story in Mexico.
What's the story?
The story is there were these seven villages, and they were harassed every evening. A giant bird would come down from the mountain, swoop down on one of the villages, and take either a young woman or a child, small prey, and swoop down, take it away every evening, and take it back to the to its mountain. And finally, a little boy, a young boy, grew up in one of the villages and vowed that he would get that monster. He set off on an expedition after talking to the elders. They told him where to go. He went up into the mountains and found an area where there were all kinds of bones, which he thought were the bones of the victims that, that this giant bird had taken up to his nest. And
right.
He hid in a pit until he saw the giant bird, jumped out, shot an arrow, killed the giant bird, went back to the village, took all the elders. All the elders and the warriors came with him to the mountain to see the bones of this creature, the body, the carcass of the giant bird that he killed. And what's interesting to me is that in the Southwest, in Apache and Navajo myth, it's the same kind of story of this giant bird that just preys on humans. And, you know, we were the prey of these large animals. So, of course, you tell these stories. This is how you, you know, keep...
This is how you save the babies. This is how you save people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is how you got to let people know what the dangers of the world are if you don't pass these along. And why would they spend so much time telling these stories if they didn't have value? I would argue that we would be culturally bigoted to think that these stories could only have been for entertainment value.
Oh, because... they're not just for entertainment. No.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one reason why we like these stories today. They keep us on our toes. I mean, we face all kinds of dangers. We've got to keep those, you know, adrenaline flowing.
You know, I'm looking at the top of the hour here, and we never got to the UFO thing, so I want to ask you the UFO question here in just a second, because I know that it was something that was just brought to my attention yesterday, and I don't have any idea where you're going with that, so I'm really curious. But then I also want to ask you about let's go to the biblical story of Noah and the big fish, or the whale, as we commonly think of it, too. And I want to ask you about some of the monsters then of that. What might of other stories were there of these other giant water beasts that the early inhabitants of the planet were facing, that they passed down? And that takes us to the cover of Fossil Legends of the First Americans, too, where early Americans would find these bones, and they would start to imagine, how did these bones come to be where we're finding them? What had happened? And how accurate they were. In particular, that idea of the water monsters. In the middle of the desert, they're finding these creatures, and they're able to imagine that these were swimming giant reptiles long before anybody else had thought of them. We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM with Adrian Mayer. My name is Ian Punnett.